from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Someday soon, I'm going to open this show with news from Tulsa, or Santa Barbara, Fargo, or Buffalo. Nothing from Washington, nothing about the White House. This is not that week. President Trump faces a report he directed his former personal lawyer to lie to Congress about contact with Russia. And earlier this week, the president's current lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, was on the hot seat as he sought to defend Trump over links to that country.
I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign.
Yes, you
have. I have not.
The shutdown hits day 28. Some federal employees say they're having to choose among their bills for food, rent, and medicine. Kansas City IRS employee Shannon Ellis said she's required to return to work this week.
I am now officially one of the essential employees, and so I will be forced to go back to work with no pay.
Join us. How does the report that Trump directed his personal attorney to lie to Congress affect your feelings about the president? What questions do you have over the latest revelations about Trump's relationship with Russia? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is Anita Kumar, the White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. Anita, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, David.
Also joining us from Washington is Zach Beecham. He's a senior correspondent at Vox, covers global politics and ideology. He also hosts Worldly, Vox's podcast on foreign policy and international relations. Zach, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Anita, and Zach.
So let's start. I don't think we can fail to start with the report that popped overnight from BuzzFeed News about reporting that the president directed his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about his interactions with the Russians over a possible business deal in 2016. And I want to say from the outset, for folks outside journalism, BuzzFeed News may be sort of a smile or chuckle. Inside journalism, BuzzFeed News, dead serious. The two writers on this, one a Pulitzer winner, the other one of the most distinguished freedom of information reporters in the country. Anita Kumar, how serious a story is this for the White House?
I mean, you saw the initial reaction just overnight since it came out, people really taking this very seriously. I will add that I have not seen that other media outlets have confirmed this. So this is all from BuzzFeed at the moment. You saw the White House and Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's attorney, kind of push back on it and say the same thing they've been saying over and over, which is this came from Michael Cohen. You know, he's been convicted of perjury. He is a liar and he's not telling the truth. But if you read the BuzzFeed story, it actually is much, their sourcing is much greater than that. They're saying it's coming from federal law enforcement officials and it's coming from documents, text messages. And so it seems to be something very serious. The White House is very much dismissing it, though, that as they have with everything else.
And indeed, it seems as though if you look at the story closely, that in fact, that Robert Mueller's special counsel and his prosecutors got the account from Michael Cohen after ascertaining there was this this question of directing him to lie to Congress. And that is that Cohen was sort of substantiating what they found, according to BuzzFeed, not being the person to plant the idea in the special prosecutor's mind. I want to go to the heart of this, Zach Beecham, and talk a little bit about what the implications are. Earlier this week, we heard William Barr. He's Trump's nominee for attorney general, who held that same job 27 years ago under President George H.W. Bush. He's being questioned by the Senate Judiciary Committee on Tuesday. The new chairman of the committee, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, the Republican, asked about Barr's view and definition on obstruction of justice.
So if there was some reason to believe that the president tried to coach somebody not to testify or testify falsely, that could be obstruction of justice.
Yes, under that. Yeah, under an obstruction statute,
right.
Yes.
So if there's some evidence that the president tried to conceal evidence, that would be obstruction of justice potentially, right?
Right.
So Zach Beecham, understanding that this is based currently on the BuzzFeed News account, how squarely does this report fall under that rubric? That is, how close does this get us to the question of obstruction of justice by the president of the United States?
Oh, man, it's pretty close. The one qualm I have is that obstruction usually, when we're talking about Trump, refers to obstruction of the Russia investigation and the Mueller probe. And this was lying about sort of the basically Trump business interests in Russia. So it's not necessarily hiding the Trump campaign's collusion with Russia. So you could see Republicans politically dismissing it on those grounds, but not legally, right? And that's an important distinction here. Not only that, like elsewhere in the Senate testimony, Senator Amy Klobuchar asked Barr if asking somebody to lie to Congress would be a felony itself, and Barr said yes, and it would. That is illegal. So it seems that if this report is true, unequivocally, the president was involved in one, if not multiple, different felonies.
Jack Beatty, how do you evaluate this report, particularly in light of what we learned over the course of last weekend, the New York Times reporting that the FBI had actually opened an inquiry after FBI Director Jim Comey's dismissal by the president into whether the president somehow was acting as an agent on behalf of Russian interests?
Well, those reports, and this adds to them, substantiate a view of the president as fundamentally disloyal. That possibility has to be out there. We may be weeks away from comparing him to some of the great villains in American history. Perhaps not. But what strikes me about this BuzzFeed revelation is, the first article of impeachment against Richard Nixon was, quote, obstruction by directing others to lie. In the Clinton impeachment, he encouraged Monica Lewinsky to lie. And 14 sitting current Republican senators voted to remove Bill Clinton from office, partly on the basis of that coaching a witness to lie in an official investigation. They're going to have some difficulty, if it gets to the Senate, explaining why they could vote to remove Bill Clinton on that basis, but not Donald Trump.
Anita Kumar, in the confirmation hearings for the Attorney General nominee, Bill Barr, it seemed as though there were two strains that came to the fore, that Barr was an institutionalist who very much revered the traditions and practices of the Justice Department and of law enforcement and the FBI, and that also he was skeptical, as was revealed in a memo he wrote to the Trump camp last year, skeptical about the ability of the FBI or the special prosecutor to interpret certain acts by the president as criminal. Which Bill Barr emerged more strongly this week?
That's a great question, and that's what senators are going to be sort of looking at. I mean, I think that before the hearing started, I think the senators, both parties, were saying, look at this person. He worked for the elder George Bush before. He is not a Trump guy. It's not about this administration. He's a Republican. He's been around. He's been in Washington. And he's qualified. He has the experience. Many of Trump's picks do not have the experience, are not qualified, have never worked in government. So, I there was that. And then you go into the hearing, and the hearing was long, and it was about a variety of things. But you're right, it ended up being about whether he's able to be independent from President Trump. Is he going to be able to leave the investigation, the Russia investigation, alone? Is he going to release the document, the report about the Russia investigation? That seems to be the key thing right now. So, the senators have to weigh that. There's both of those sides to him. And I think if you talk to the Democratic senators, they're really looking at this issue about, will he be independent from President Trump? Can he stand up to President Trump? Will he be transparent about what the Russia investigation is about? And that's what we're going to be hearing about the next few weeks until they make a decision here.
Now, also this week, Republicans on the Judiciary Committee pressed up Bill Barr about whether or not he'd be willing to look into the propriety of that FBI investigation. And while that does seem to follow the game plan of always trying to investigate the investigations when it comes to this presidency, there is something in which you might imagine there's some reason to be at least concerned about the FBI investigating a sitting president. That said, the president was asked about this in a New York Times report by one of his media friends, Fox News host Jeanine Pirro, and she asked President Trump point blank over that weekend whether he has ever worked for Russia.
I'm going to ask you, are you now or have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing. But the headline of that article, it's called The Failing New York Times for a Reason.
Zach Beecham, not exactly a precise denial, although the White House rushed something out to sort of undo the damage later. What do you make of the president at this point in his stance towards Russia?
Well, I think it's very funny that he says it's called The Failing New York Times. You call it The Failing New York Times. Nobody else does that. But look, putting that aside, the president has this very strange relationship with Russia, where he is personally quite friendly, and everything he says and does as an individual suggests that he indeed has uncomfortably close ties to the Kremlin. On the other hand, his administration's policy has been more lukewarm. A lot of it has been set by former Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, or the outgoing Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, and it was more confrontational, more in line with what traditional American foreign policy would be when it comes to Russia. So,
Zach, has anything that we've learned briefly before our break, but has anything we've learned in recent days or recent weeks strongly changed what we actually thought of or knew about the president and his relationship to the Russians, whether politically or personally?
Politically, I would say no. Substantively, the closest thing is this report that we've been talking about, the BuzzFeed piece. If it is the case that Trump was actively pursuing business deals with Russia during the presidency and directing his people to lie about that, well, that sure is an incentive for Russia to try to help him out during the campaign.
Or trying to get them to lie to Congress about what he had done, perhaps during the campaign itself, maybe not even expecting that he'd get to the White House. We're talking about the top stories of the week. You can join our conversation. I'd like Anita, Zach, and Jack to hang on there. I'd like you to hang on there. If you favor Trump or if you oppose him, what would change your mind? Where do you put the blame for the government shutdown? How's it affecting you? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week's news. You can join our conversation. The White House and the House of Representatives are skirmishing over the shutdown. What do you see as the way out? The House condemned and stripped Congressman Steve King of some of his powers over his racist remarks. What do you think of that episode? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Zach Beecham of Vox, Anita Kumar of Politico, and On Point's Jack Beattie. I want to take at least one of your calls right now as they're coming in. We've got a call from Charleston, South Carolina. Jim, go ahead.
Hi. One of the questions you asked at the beginning of the show of your listeners was, what would I like to know about what would I really like to know about Trump and the investigation? And in my way of thinking, I would really want to know, what does Russia have over Trump? I mean, from the beginning, during his campaign, he had an unusual support of Russia and of Putin. And then he had, when he got elected, he had personal and very private talks with Putin, and we were denied as the public of that information, of those interviews, and then also the fact that he acted in a public servant at that point. Also, I believe he did his best to undermine the Magnitsky Act and his obvious reference to adoption talks with Putin was an attempt, because the adoption was in retaliation to the Magnitsky Act. So it was obviously
right. Certain kinds of sanctions economically on dealing with Russian figures.
Say it again. I missed that.
I'm sorry. Forgive me, Jim. I'm just saying what you're referring to is a law that puts certain kinds of economic sanctions on dealing with Russian figures.
Against the oligarchs and the, right. and the plutarchs of Russia. He also has had recent attempts to lift the sanctions against a plutarch, an oligarch in Russia.
Sure.
And they had these bizarre meetings with the Russians in the White House.
Why don't we turn that then to our panel here for a moment? I appreciate you raising the question. Jack Beatty, there was this report in the Washington Post that President Trump basically tried to insist that people not know of certain kinds of conversations he had had with Vladimir Putin, and that, in fact, he had tried to destroy the notes of or seize the notes of an interpreter to ensure that they weren't somehow distributed, among others, so that people knew what was going on. Does it have to be that Putin, as Jim asked, has something on Trump, or could there be something else, including business interests or just his desire to have a different, stronger relationship with Putin and Russia?
That's possible, but it seems the credibility of that becomes more and more attenuated. I mean, you just can't believe all these things are coincidences or innocent actions. And as to Jim's point, what does Putin have over him? What might he have over the president? You know, there's been lots of reporting about the possibility of money laundering, of Trump, the Trump enterprises being propped up one way or another by money from Russia. That's over some years. And there's on the public record his son saying, oh, we're doing great with money from Russia. I think that was 10 years ago.
Right.
And then, of course, there's the campaign itself as a form of leverage. If the campaign was colluding with Russia, if the president knew about that, that itself is a form, is a leverage point for the Russians. So those two things alone, I think, are what we're going to hear more and more about when the Mueller report comes out.
And perhaps is what makes it so interesting that Giuliani seemed to retreat from saying, there was no collusion to, the president didn't collude. I'm not talking about the campaign or people associated with it. I do want to turn now to another big matter, of course, and that is the partial government shutdown, which is going on. And first, I want to acknowledge and point out the human toll here, human toll on a couple of different levels. One is that, the services being provided for American citizens, people live in this country. You see no chemical inspections by the EPA. We're just given a couple of examples. Each week, the EPA performs over 200 inspections of chemical factories, water treatment plants, other industrial sites to ensure regulations with the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts are complied with. None of those are happening. There's a disproportionate impact on veterans. So, for example, an estimated 250,000 veterans are not receiving paychecks during the shutdown because they work for the federal workforce. School lunches are shrinking in at least one North Carolina school district. Firefighters are postponing training in Oregon. And here's another way. It's done. A 30-year career diplomat, W. Patrick Murphy, posted on Twitter yesterday. He said, 30 years of public service, 17 school changes for the kids, 14 international moves, 12 months in combat zone, 10 secretaries of state, 7 cases of malaria, 5 mutinies and coups, 4 dozen colleagues killed in action, 2 million plus miles in airplanes, first day without a paycheck. But he concludes, we're still proud to serve. Anita Kumar, where does the shutdown stand?
Pretty much the same as it stood a few weeks ago. They are at a stalemate here. From the White House perspective, they do not seem to be looking to sort of have a discussion where, or maybe neither side is. I mean, the Democrats didn't show up to the White House this week. You know, they're not at a place where they're even negotiating, right? They're both sides are still where they are. The Democrats don't want to fund President Trump's border wall. President Trump wants some money for that wall. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of negotiating going on, and both sides are standing firm. Obviously, you've mentioned so much going on with the shutdown that's not good for the federal workforce. It's not good for people who aren't working. It's not good for people who are working without money. It's not, in this long term here, going to be good for the economy. So nobody really wants it to continue on, but nobody's giving in at all. And you've seen just these last couple days, just this back and forth between the president and Speaker Pelosi. You know, she's saying,
well,
don't come.
Let's dip into that. Let's hear how she put it. She had a weekly press conference. She repeated her, call it request, call it suggestion, call it strong advice, that the president postpone his State of the Union address. And she said, hey, shutdowns have consequences. She has concerns about the security costs of federal agencies running without funding during this shutdown.
I have no doubt that our men and women in the federal workforce have the capability to protect the inference that they want to say is, oh, you don't think they could. Yes, they can. They're professionals. They trained for this. They should be paid for this. And that's why I said to the president, if you don't open up government, if that doesn't happen, let's discuss a mutually agreeable date.
Zach Beauchamp, is this pure political theater, or is there more at work?
I mean, the State of the Union is pure political theater. That's the nature of the whole event. So obviously putting this in the context of the shutdown is a way of putting leverage on Trump. He loves seeing himself on television. He loves talking to large audiences. So depriving him of that pageantry does make him angry. And we saw the consequences of that anger actually today when it bled over from political theater into real life threat. According to Nancy Pelosi's office, the Trump administration leaked her travel plan to Afghanistan on commercial airlines, forcing her to cancel it. Now, that's a serious escalation, right? That's essentially putting an important government official at risk by saying where they might be. Again, if this comment is true, and that's just remarkable that these two people are making it so personal. And I don't want to both sides this, right, and make it seem as if they're both equally culpable. The president in each case is the aggressor. The president is the one who is taking things beyond the normal push and pull of politics into dangerous, actual harm-causing territory for both ordinary people and potentially the leader of his political opposition. It's really troubling.
I'd like to take a couple calls now on this very topic. Calling from Lexington, Kentucky is Jelizabeth. Thank you so much for joining us. What does this shutdown do to you? What do you think about that?
Well, I'm very frustrated by the shutdown on multiple levels. First of all, my mother received her retirement as a veteran of the U.S. Air Force, and I'm concerned if she's going to be able, you know, to get paid or not. I'm so frustrated with our Congress that they're able to go home and go on recess when there are people who are not working. And I'm really to a boiling point that I want the TSA to go on strike. I want federal prisons to go on strike. I want the IRS to go on strike. I want something to happen until everybody is feeling it and Congress does their job and people who aren't paying attention get off the internet, get off TV, and put the pressure on Congress. And I'm most frustrated being in Kentucky with Senator Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, who had aspirations for the presidency. Do something. Do your jobs. Don't leave Washington. They have got to resolve this. And I do put the blame on President Trump and the stupid wall that the majority of the country doesn't want. It has got to end, and they have got to do their job.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call. A Norma Ray moment from Lexington, Kentucky. We'll go now to Morehead City, North Carolina. Silas, what do you think about the shutdown? Where do you think it can be resolved?
Hi, David. I think the issue about the wall has been totally mischaracterized by both the president and Nancy Pelosi. It's this all-or-none thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is an appropriations fight. There is no law that requires a wall to be built. You'd think that would come first. Then you appropriate money for it. But they're just appropriating under the general Homeland Security Authority to do what they think is needed at the border with whatever funds are available. Within that framework, it's easy to compromise. Homeland Security will have priorities, which they may not have articulated yet, but the Democrats could easily acquiesce to prioritize certain barrier building areas. There's no law that forbids that. And Donald Trump simply admits that I don't have a law yet that requires the building of a wall along the entire border.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you're basically, Silas, just to be clear, you're basically saying Democrats should give money for border security and allow the discretion for Department of Homeland Security to say this is where it needs to be done in line with what the president's priorities are.
Yeah.
And so everybody gets to save face there, yeah?
Well, no, it has to be. Yeah, Homeland Security should have a plan of some kind to justify a supplemental appropriation, an appropriation above their.
All right. Well, let's throw this out to our folks here. Thank you for that, Silas. Jack Beatty, what do you think? What in analyzing what you've seen play out in the rhetoric and what you've seen not play out, what makes sense as a possible legislative path forward?
Well, I think Silas puts his finger on it. Both sides have to save face. President Bush I recently died, and in the obituaries, it came out how conscious he was that Gorbachev had to save face of Gorbachev when the wall came down. He didn't want to put their face in. He dealt with this moment of potential peril with grace and with tact and prudence, he essentially was allowing the other side to save face. If the Democrats now would say, "Mr. Trump, we'll meet you halfway, we'll go for $2.5 billion, what do you say?" They would call his bluff. If he said no, well, then it will be clear that the Democrats had done what they're elected to do, which is to compromise, not simply to make government work. They're not doing that now. They're posing. They're doing this for their base. And if it's a matter of a couple of billion dollars, I really think they should make that kind of gesture. They're not, because they see what's happening. Since December, according to the Marist poll on NPR, the president is down 7 points overall. He's down, and his base appears to be cracking. He's down 9 points among Republicans, 7 points among white men without college degrees, 13 points among white evangelicals, 18 points among suburban men, and 24 points the president is down among white women with college degrees through this shutdown. The Democrats want it to run on so it'll do further damage. But meanwhile, government is not working.
And interestingly, I saw a Pew poll that if you add the people who want who basically oppose the wall outright and the people who support funding for the president's wall proposals but could live with the shutdown being resolved without any money for that, that's over two-thirds of the country, according to the recent Pew poll. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thing. I want to turn Anita Kumar to another development in Congress, and that is the stripping of a lot of the status and power of Republican Steve King of Iowa. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, said he stripped King of those committee assignments over a long history of racist comments and alliances.
There is no room for white supremacy. That's why I took a strong action. That's why I wanted to make a statement. That's why I did something, and the steering committee did as well, and the whole body.
Anita Kumar, this was in response to an interview Steve King gave to Trip Gabriel at the New York Times. It's pretty stark. He said, you know, what's wrong with white supremacy, basically. But this is not new for Steve King, not new by a long shot. Why is this happening right now?
Yeah, it is not new. And you saw Congressman King quickly say that his comments were taken out of context. But they're not new. And you saw really strong reactions, I thought, from the House Republicans you just played. Also, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell with a very, very strong response. And stripping of him, let's be clear, stripping him of his committee assignments basically means stripping him of his job, right? He's still there, but the work that's done is done in committee, and he is not, he's not going to be able to vote and do things in committee, and that his district in Iowa just basically doesn't have a representative. You know, Tripp, I saw of the New York Times did a follow up story about what people in Iowa think in his district, and it was such an interesting story about how they basically think, even though he's been doing this for a long time, they think this means he's done. And he is done. He's saying he's sticking it out, but this basically means they don't have anyone there. And I do think it was sort of a turning point here. We've seen a lot of criticism of the Republican Party in the last couple of years not standing up to President Trump on some of the things that he said. I don't think we've seen anything change on that, but I think they're saying with some other people here, it's time. We can't continue on like this. Let's remember they lost the House.
Yeah, right. And at the same time, Anita, you know, is there a way in which, as some Democratic critics have charged, this is a way for them to slap at some of the rhetoric from the president without actually addressing the president?
Yeah, but I think we've seen more people say, more Democrats say, oh, they're just doing this. They're not going to fight who they really need to fight. And that's President Trump and all that he says. You know, a lot of Democrats I've talked to and a lot of Democrats you hear from say this is just weak. They should have done this before with this congressman, but also should have pushed back on so many things in the last 2 years since Donald Trump has been president.
It's also been interesting to see the Republican leadership then pivoting and using that to say, we've done this, and now Democrats have to look at themselves a little harder at some of their rhetoric. Folks, we're discussing this week's top stories with Anita Kumar, Zach Beecham, Jack Beatty. We want you to join our conversation. Do you have questions over what the collapse of the Brexit vote means for the UK? Good news, you've got plenty of company. So do the Brits. We'll try to offer some answers. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. You can join our conversations. Omnia Shambles in Britain, a deadly strike killing Americans in Syria. Join our conversation with your questions. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Anita Kumar of Politico, Zach Beecham of Vox, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Before we turn our lonely eyes abroad, I wanted to take a call from Baltimore, Maryland. Danny, I understand you were stirred by our conversation about Steve King and race. What strikes you about it?
It's simple. The fact that this man has a blatant history of being extremely racist in his own state and nationally, and just, you know, just happens to be a very, very racist president, and they finally want to censure him. This should have been done 3 years ago. You know, the man has been an advocate of white supremacy his entire career, and he's gone against women's right to choose our bodies.
Mm-hmm. And you equate those in terms of race. You're saying that basically because he had made comments about Latin American immigrants, because he had made comments about wanting to keep America looking homogenous, essentially white civilization, European civilization, that Congress should have done what?
They should have ousted him a long time ago. This mm-hmm. isn't a censure thing, you know, and for them to have even allowed a candidate like 45, I refuse to dignify his name ever. But to allow someone like him to rise through their ranks, to throw away almost every single part of the GOP that I've known growing up, which I'm 34 years old, and I'm originally from Omaha, Nebraska. I moved in 2016 because I could see which way my state was going. I wouldn't be a part of that. So I moved here to Baltimore. So I'm very familiar with Republicans and their history. And the fact that 45 is in there now, and they just now want to act on his behavior, it's nothing but a ploy to say, oh, look, guys, we do care about racism to a certain level. Look at what we did to Steve, even though our leader in chief, who we fall in line with every day with his racist comments, you know, we're now going to put Steve on the back burner, but let this man stay the head of our party. It's nothing but an act.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that, Danny. You can hear there some of the intensity of feeling about this incredibly incendiary issue. We are now going to turn to Britain, where there have been, you know, we're partially shut down in our government. Their government is in a kind of paralysis. A major vote on the prime minister's proposals to severed essentially ties Britain and the European Union went down, and then she narrowly survived a vote of no confidence in British Parliament. We're talking, of course, about Prime Minister Theresa May. In winning that vote, she made it clear to the Parliament that she has no intention of pulling back on her party's promise to leave the EU.
My government will continue its work to increase our prosperity, guarantee our security, and to strengthen our union. And yes, we will also continue to work to deliver on the solemn promise we made to the people of this country to deliver on the result of the referendum and leave the European Union.
Zach Beauchamp, sometimes it feels like Prime Minister Theresa May is driving down a one-way street that happens to dead end. What does she do here?
You know, there's a definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over again. And that's what it feels like Theresa May is doing sometimes. Everyone in the UK thinks her plan B, after losing this Brexit vote, the vote on the terms of the deal, by a historic proportion, we're talking the largest we've ever seen in modern British history, over 100 members of her own party defected, right? She wants to submit the same plan again and be like, okay, you all voted this down last time. Now you're going to support it, right? And obviously they're not going to, because the truth of the matter is there's nothing more she could do if she wants to continue down the Brexit path, right? The choices are end your really kind of obviously counterproductive and dangerous quest to leave the European Union, but one that would be politically difficult for her. It would cost her premiership almost certainly, or try to work out some kind of negotiated deal, because a non-negotiated deal would destroy the British economy. And that deadline is coming up on March 29th. They either have a deal, postpone, don't leave the EU, or they're out and the British economy goes to hell. So that's the situation Theresa May finds herself in. And she doesn't seem to have any better solution than trying to push this negotiated deal, which just can't pass muster with a British parliament.
Jack Beattie, does it seem to you as though there's a legitimate way in which they could actually have a second referendum, which you hear some in the Labour Party trying to push, and even a few, I believe, members of other parties in Parliament calling for?
Yes. David Miliband, the former foreign secretary under the last Labour government, was on NPR this morning, and he said, you know, the first referendum – The voters didn't have informed consent. That is, they were mystified by propaganda about the money that they're spending in the EU, they could go into the national health and they'd come out to billions better off. Well, in fact, it was just the opposite. They have to pay a ransom, a sort of divorce settlement of billions to get out of the settlement. So they were bamboozled by this demagogic campaign. They didn't realize the cost. Now, when the costs have been documented, when people have said this is going to happen and that's going to happen and we're going to have to pay, the national health is not going to inherit all this money, the case can be made for having a new choice. We'll have to see.
Yeah, I was just going to say, couldn't you argue in a lot of controversial things that go to a public plebiscite, a referendum of some sort, people can always after the fact say, well, we didn't really have the information or we didn't know all of the consequences. Does this really distinctively different?
You can, and that's what's so risky about referenda, that they're, you know, that it puts government policy hostage to momentary majorities who can be motivated by, you know, propaganda, and in this case, Russian-inflected propaganda. To me, the best lines of the week came from Nicholas Soames, Winston Churchill's grandson, who quoted one of his grandfather's favorite bits of poetry, and it goes, "Who is in charge of the clattering train, the axles creak and the coupling strain? For the pace is hot and the points are near, and sleep hath deadened the driver's ear, and signals flash through the night in vain. Who is in charge of the clattering train?"
Well, let's take this clattering train all the way to Park Falls, Wisconsin. We've got a call from Phil. Phil, tell us what you think about Brexit.
Well, I think they should go through with Brexit at all costs, because the EU is just plain England for a cash cow. And it would personally gratify me quite a bit if they did get out of the EU, because when I first heard of the EU, I predicted it would never last and it would be money that would cause it to break down. Because the different countries in Europe have completely different attitudes about money. England is proud of their pound. During my whole life, it's always been worth over $2.
Well, more like $1.50, $1.60 these days, but a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, but anyway, like Italy's attitude toward money is, oh, million lira here, million lira there, here, have a couple more million lira, you know? And that doesn't work for long. And I think they just they use England the same way the NATO alliance and the United Nations use America.
Well, that's actually an interesting jumping off point, Phil, and I appreciate that call. Anita Kumar, obviously the president has been challenged, has challenged the wisdom of staying in NATO and has challenged the wisdom in many fronts of these international alliances, entanglements, call them what you will. How does Brexit fit in with that, and how does that fit in with the president's vision of what a multilateral relations should look like?
Right. I mean, when he was speaking just now, I was thinking that sounds like a lot like Donald Trump. I mean, you know, President Trump has come into office when he campaigned and now that he's been in office for 2 years, pretty much saying the same thing. And we see it in all sorts of ways all over the world where he says, you know, we aren't getting our fair share. The United States is not getting our fair share from these agreements, these alliances. We need to pull back. You know, when I saw the news that was reported about NATO, it didn't seem surprising. That's the thing. That's the philosophy he's been talking about. Same with Brexit. I mean, you know, we haven't heard a whole lot from him about that right this instance. But in the past, when he's talked about it, he's also talked about how they've done the right thing and then he should get out. I mean, this is his philosophy. For whatever reason, it's different than we've seen in past presidents, that he feels like it's about the United States, America first, as he says over and over again. And that is his foreign policy that he's brought to the White House.
I want to turn. I imagine, Zach Beauchamp, you would say, you know, basically the EU has brought certain economic benefits. But I want to point your attention to a different issue abroad, and that is the question of what's happening in Syria right now. On Wednesday, the same day that ISIS an ISIS claimed attack, let's put it that way, killed U.S. service members in Syria, Vice President Mike Pence declared at a State Department conference that the Islamic State, that is ISIS, has been defeated.
Thanks to the leadership of this commander-in-chief and the courage and sacrifice of our armed forces, we're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners, and we are bringing our troops home. The caliphate has crumbled and ISIS has been defeated.
In just a minute or two, we'll be joined by Richard Engel, NBC's chief foreign correspondent, who's just left Syria. But Zach Beauchamp, give us the little synopsis here. How accurate is what Mike Pence had to say?
On one level, it's completely accurate. And on another level, it's entirely inaccurate. On the first level, when he says the caliphate has been defeated, that's true, right? And by that, he means ISIS's territorial empire. The group used to be like a mini state. It controlled territory, it administered a government, the whole thing. And that's been defeated, not necessarily by Trump. The policy was put in place by Obama, and most of the work was done by local forces. But nonetheless, that has been destroyed. But it's not true in the sense that ISIS still exists as a terrorist group, an insurgent group. It doesn't control territory. It hides among the population and then commits various different attacks, atrocities, basically designed to undermine its opponents without outright reconstituting its territorial empire and lay the groundwork for a territorial resurgence in the future. So to say ISIS has been defeated, full stop, is to miss the point in a way because, you know, this is what we said about al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2008. And of course, that group wasn't defeated. It had been rendered an insurgent group and would later come back as ISIS. So the vice president's being blinkered, I would say.
You're hearing there the voice of Zach Beauchamp, senior correspondent at Vox, who covers global politics. Zach, great to have you today.
Oh, thank you.
We've also been hearing from Anita Kumar. She's White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. Thanks, Anita.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
Four Americans were killed in that explosion I mentioned in northern Syria on Wednesday. The Islamic State claims responsibility for the attack in the town of Munbej, located close to the Turkish border. With us now to talk about the story from Istanbul is Richard Engel. He's chief foreign correspondent for NBC News and has spent the past week in northern Syria. Richard, good to have you with us.
That's a pleasure. How are you?
I'm okay. So tell us a little bit about not just about the attack, but what it tells us about status there.
So let me just give you a few details about the attack. And I think the details about the attack also reveal the status of the group. Mm-hmm. So American personnel, it's been revealed now they were a combination of troops and contractors and intelligence personnel, were in Munbej, and they went to a restaurant. And that's okay, people have to eat. They go out on a patrol. They need to pick up food. The problem was the pattern that was set. This was one of only two restaurants in Manbij that American forces tended to stop at to pick up sandwiches or to sit down inside and grab a meal, which made it an easy target. And on that day, lying in wait was an ISIS suicide bomber who casually walked up among them, walked at the door, and exploded his device, and with devastating consequences. So what it says is the group is still out there, but doesn't control Manbij. This kind of attack is, frankly, very hard to prevent. Sure, the American troops could have exercised a little bit more caution. They could have varied their routes. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions about that. But that kind of attack, where you have a lone suicide bomber who waits for an opportunity to strike, doesn't say very much about the strength of ISIS. I think we're going to see that kind of attack going forward against whatever target it happens to be, if it's American troops or Syrians or a market, for quite some time in Syria. But going back to what your guest was saying, it's the timing. Why would ISIS now feel emboldened, feel that it wants to carry out attacks?
And of course, there's the question of American troops and whether they're being withdrawn and how quickly.
Exactly. And the coalition partner that Vice President Pence was talking about is this Kurdish-led force. I was talking to the commander of that Kurdish-led force. I spoke to lots of commanders with that group. It's a combination of Kurdish and Arab forces, about 65,000 strong. And they're very worried that by announcing that American troops are leaving, and then saying that we don't know how long they're going to stay, but we're leaving, that the war is over, it's encouraging ISIS to step up the pace of attacks, so that it can change the narrative, so that ISIS can say, weren't defeated, and B, it was us that pushed out the American troops, and allow ISIS to effectively try to claim victory from defeat.
Somehow dictating terms. We have a listener who writes on our website, if the troops had been totally withdrawn from Syria, then four more Americans would have been coming back alive. At the same time, as you're suggesting, there are a lot of folks who say this is going to undermine our ability to work with other countries and helping to determine what the future of Syria looks like and, by extension, what the future of the Middle East does.
So back to your point that was just made. So had the troops not been there, then there's no troops to attack. Clear. Makes sense. There will be those people, and there already are those people who make that argument. Pull them out now, then there's nothing to hit, and who cares what happens? Damn the consequences. The problem is the consequences are very, very real. They're very strategic. There is this allied force of 65,000 people that would be abandoned, that would be left behind, that would have its weapons taken away, that would be facing a fight that it would certainly lose against Turkey. It would be forced to make an agreement with the Assad regime. It would be forced to make an agreement with Russia.
Yep. Yep. So, and that's the voice there of Richard Engel. Richard, thank you so much. He's chief foreign correspondent for NBC News. Appreciate your time. You can continue our conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter, on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.